Luke 24:13-35. Now that same day, two of them were going to a village called Emmaus, about 7 miles from Jerusalem. They were talking with each other about everything that had happened. As they talked and discussed these things with each other, Jesus himself came up and walked along with them, but they were kept from recognizing him. He asked them, "What are you discussing together as you walk along?" They stood still, their faces downcast. One of them, named Cleopas, asked him, "Are you only a visitor to Jerusalem and do not know the things that have happened there in these days?" "What things?" he asked. "About Jesus of Nazareth," they replied. "He was a prophet, powerful in word and deed before God and all the people. The chief priests and our rulers handed him over to be sentenced to death, and they crucified him. But we had hoped he was the one who was going to redeem Israel. And what is more, it is the third day since all this took place. In addition, some of our women amazed us. They went to the tomb early this morning, but they didn't find his body. They came and told us that they had seen a vision of angels who said he was alive. Then some of our companions went to the tomb and found it just as the women had said, but him they did not see. He said to them, 'How foolish you are, and how slow of heart to believe all that the prophets have spoken. Did not the Christ have to suffer these things and then enter his glory?' And beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he explained to them what was said in all the scriptures concerning himself." As they approached the village to which they were going, Jesus acted as if he were going farther. But they urged him strongly, "Stay with us, for it is nearly evening. The day is almost over." So he went in to stay with them. When he was at the table with them, he took bread, gave thanks, broke it, and began to give it to them. Then their eyes were opened, and they recognized him, and he disappeared from their sight. They asked each other, "Were not our hearts burning within us while he talked with us on the road and opened the scriptures to us?" They got up and returned at once to Jerusalem. There they found the 11 and those with them assembled together and saying, "It is true. The Lord has risen, and he has appeared to Simon." Then the two told what had happened on the way and how Jesus was recognized by them when he broke the bread.
The little boy I'm thinking of was thrilled with an oyster shell. We live in the woods, my family and I, but we have a neighbor who has a restaurant and they serve oysters. And just about every week he comes home with a big pail of them and sticks them in the potholes of our dirt driveway. And so oyster shells find their way into our woods by means I have no idea of. We have a little grandkid about halfway up your shin. He was out searching in the woods one day, and he comes back with a treasure. Oyster shells. Seashells, he calls them. He listened for the sea. Couldn't hear any in there. There's something about finding a treasure in an unexpected place that makes it doubly good. You're on vacation. Maybe you have the guidebook of the city or town or state you're in, and they say, "Try this restaurant, try that restaurant." But you're driving on some backcountry road and stop at some little no-name diner with some waitress named Madge who comes and serves you. And it turns out to be the best food you've eaten in 6 years. Nobody ever heard of the place. Totally unexpected is what makes it so good. Well, to me, that's what this little passage is that David Kurtz just read for us. It's at a place with people you just don't expect. It's on a road to a little town that we wouldn't even know about if it weren't for this story, a no place. It's about two no-name people who aren't anybody, ordinary folks. And yet by the time you're done, it has become one of the favorite resurrection accounts of any of them in the Bible. This very morning, women have gone to the tomb of Jesus of Nazareth. They do not go to meet some risen Messiah. They go, as it were, to lay flowers at a grave of someone they know is never coming back. They see a vision of a couple angels who say he's alive, and it spooks them. And they go back to the city of Jerusalem, where Jesus, 11 apostles now, for Judas has gone to his place, are gathered, huddled in fear, and they say, "We saw an empty tomb and several angels who said, he's risen from the dead." The apostles don't believe them because nobody saw anybody risen from the dead, and, well, you know how women are, is the idea of that passage. So two of the men run to the tomb. They see an empty tomb as well, but they do not see any risen Jesus of Nazareth. And so everybody is half spooked and half scared and half sad, if you can have three halves. And so there they are. Now with them are several people who are not apostles. They're not among the 12. They are hangers-on. They're people who love the Lord, but they're in a secondary or tertiary rim on the outside of things. And they realize nothing's happening here. 3 days later, and any predictions anybody may have heard certainly are not true. And now they go out and start home on a dusty road. Their trip is like you feel when you leave the movies and are now walking out into the dim sunlight. It was so exciting in the movies. Something big was going on. At least they were gathered with the 12. But now they just start home and life seems more dull than it ever did. And here they are walking now down the road to a place. Emmaus is a little town some 7 miles from Jerusalem. Now, if you're walking aerobically, maybe 2 hours, maybe an hour and a half, you knock it off. I don't know how good you are. But if you're in heavy conversation, so you're really thinking and talking, 2, 3, 4 hours, many people who walk a lot have estimated. These people are taking that dusty road. What are they discussing? They're discussing the end of the world. A boy has dreamed of being a Navy SEAL ever since he can remember. He's always holding imaginary guns and skulking about into imaginary places and slithering underneath the tables, crawling here and there. He's always in the swimming pool at night when his parents don't know it, training and getting ready. As he gets older, he starts to run, lift weights. He's drawn to other kids who are particularly tough. He plays contact sports. They always play military. They're always with imaginary weapons, fighting imaginary guys in imaginary places. Finally, he reaches the age where he could apply. He goes through horrific training. He goes through unbelievable pressure from men who are not very nice. He survives Hell Week. And finally, at the end, he succeeds and he gets his Trident insignia. He is now a Navy SEAL. 2 weeks after his insignia is given to him, he's in a car, a drunk driver runs a red light, smashes into his vehicle, mangles his legs. The SEAL is pulled from the wreckage, and it's very clear his legs will never be normal again. He will never deploy in a SEAL mission. He retires and works in a bakery. This is exactly where these people were. For 3.5 years, they had been mesmerized by a person they could not have invented in their minds had they tried. Someone who spoke things like no one else had spoken. Someone who, when he spoke, it's like his words were like a cattle brand. They just burned themselves onto your heart. Someone whose life was so pure and so attractive. People, as it were, almost felt the waves coming from them when they were in the same room, as it were. And now, this one, whom they had started to believe could possibly be the Messiah of Israel, this one got himself arrested, shackled, dragged to a court. The gavel fell. He's pronounced guilty. They beat him to a bloody pulp. His back looks like a plowed field. They skewer him onto a post outside the city wall, and there his body twitches like a live wire. He is more than just dead. He is doubly dead. That's where they were. And so now they are skulking on their way home. 7 miles. The 11 whom they have left are cowering in a room, fearful. The mother of Jesus, a sword is piercing her heart. These two who are walking into the place, they are thinking to themselves, we must have misread the scriptures. And they're engrossed in conversation about it. Two guys. Did I say guys? There are some people who believe that this was a husband and a wife. The reason is that in the Gospel of John, in his account, when Jesus is on the cross, he mentioned that there were several women there watching whose name was Mary. One of those women was married to a man named Clopas. Mary, the wife of Clopas. That's John 19. Now, our passage says that one of the two disciples here was named Cleopas. Is it the same person? Possibly. If so, perhaps he's walking with his wife, Mary. If not, because there's just enough difference in spelling that it seems quite possible it's a different person, maybe it's two guys. Do you want to picture a husband and wife? That's legit. Do you want to picture two men, as has classically been thought? That's legit as well. As I say, they are engrossed in sad conversation. And somewhere along the road, they hear footsteps behind them. And the footsteps get closer, and finally the stranger overtakes them and walks with them. I don't know about you, but if I'm in the middle of a heavy conversation with someone that feels fairly private, it's awkward if a third person comes in the room and just sort of stands there unannounced and says hi. And so it seems to me that this is probably what happened, and perhaps they were even frustrated at the stranger, but we don't know that to be the case. The Bible says that they were kept from recognizing him. How? Did Jesus perhaps take a different form? We don't know. Or was it perhaps that just God just took away their ability to recognize him divinely? Because surely, anyone who can make blind eyes see can make seeing eyes blind. And we know there were other people who didn't recognize him. Mary, a little later, after these two had left Jerusalem, saw him at the tomb and did not recognize him, thinking he was the gardener. Later, the apostles were in Lake Galilee on boats. They saw a man yell to them from the beach. They didn't recognize he was Jesus. That's what happened here. What are you talking about? He says innocently. And here's a little verse that though I have read this passage all my life, many times, I'd never noticed. In verse 17, it says that when he asked them that, they stood still, their faces downcast. You know what it's like if you're having a conversation with someone and the person's animated, maybe he or she talks with their hands and they're into it, and then you happen to ask something in all innocence that you don't realize touches a real nerve, some great sadness that this man or woman have experienced, and then when you say it, they just freeze. They can't speak. That's what these two men did, or man and woman. They simply could not speak. And in a glum tone, they said, "Are you fresh off the farm? Are you the only person in Jerusalem? You must be a visitor who doesn't know what's been going on, the things that have happened these last few days." What things? The stranger asks innocently. Does he ask because he needs information? Oh, heavens, no. He asks because he's the kind of person to open the door for someone to speak what's in his or her heart. And they began to speak. Here's what things. Don't you know that Jesus of Nazareth, and they tell about him. Now, what they tell about Jesus of Nazareth is a door into their minds and hearts as to what they believe about this stranger, not knowing who this stranger is. And they say, first in verse 19, he was a prophet. Well, that's good as far as it goes. He certainly was a prophet. Would they like to speak a little more highly of him? Well, they do. They say, and he was powerful in word and deed. Doubtless, they're thinking about his miracles. Doubtless, they're thinking about his sermons that mesmerized even people who came to put him down. Doubtless, they're thinking about just the impact that his character had on the people who stood anywhere near him. And they said, not only was he powerful in word and deed before people, but before God. That is, you could sense that God was approving of this man. And it says, we hoped that he would redeem Israel. Notice the past tense. That's what we used to think. It's what we used to hope, but not anymore. We had hoped that he would redeem us. That is, probably, that he would help us no longer be a nation that was conquered by the foreigners, the Romans. And perhaps that he would help us with our sins, because as a nation, we really aren't doing very well at all. And we're kind of a pariah state. And there's a lot going on that just isn't very good. Well, then they say, we don't understand, verse 20, how our own leaders arrested him and put him to death. Do you notice in verse 20, they don't say that the Romans crucified him. They said our leaders crucified him. They realize something is wrong in Israel, that a man so good could see such hostility from the religious leaders of their day. They don't know what to think. And then the cherry on top of the sundae, to use a bad analogy, is this. And besides, they say, it's the third day. Rumor had it that Jesus had said he'd rise on the third day. Day one's done. Day two is done. And do you notice how low the sun is as we speak right here on day three? We left Jerusalem a few hours ago because obviously the game was over. It is true, they say, maybe some tiny glimmer of hope. It is true that some of our women said that they had gone to the tomb and found it empty. Who knows what that's about? But they did not see any Jesus of Nazareth, of course. And then a couple of our men, talking about James and John, ran to the tomb, and they found it empty. But neither did they see any Jesus, of course. And so they go home discouraged and sad. They're sort of caught between a tiny little bit of faith. They still hope, maybe, and all their fears. Now, like a person who desperately wants a job, hands in an application and gets a call, we'd like to talk to you by phone. And so you do a phone interview, and afterwards they call back and say, we enjoyed that phone interview. Maybe you can get the job. Let's interview you personally. And so you go to the second interview. You're discouraged because they haven't called. You're encouraged because they have called. You go to the second interview. They say, don't call us, we'll call you. You're discouraged because they haven't called. They call again. Maybe we could talk one more time. You're encouraged. They call again. They don't call again for 10 days. You're discouraged because they don't call. That's where these people are. They're just being jerked around, and they're exhausted. So the stranger, now it's his turn to talk, and he said to them these comforting words. How foolish you are. Was he being mean and unkind? Did he not have a heart? We'll come back to this at the very end. How slow of heart to believe all that the prophets have spoken. He's talking, of course, about all the Old Testament prophets. For the Bible that day was the Jewish scriptures in Hebrew, as it were, what we would say Genesis through Malachi. His rebuke to them is not that they're sad over the death of their friend. It's that they don't seem to believe the Bible, because he said specifically that you don't believe all that the prophets had spoken. What does he mean by that? They certainly believed a lot of it. They believed all the passages about the Messiah coming one day and having his glorious reign that everybody has loved, but they did not get the passages about the Messiah suffering. Oh, they got the passages that say from Jeremiah, the days are coming when a king will reign wisely and do what is just, and he will save Israel and Judah will live in safety. Oh, they got that. They got the passage in Isaiah 11 where the wolf is going to lie down with the lamb and a little kid will go up and grab a lion by its mane and lead him around like little kids do, and the lion will just put up with it and roll his eyes and lick the kid. They get the passages about a little kid playing near the hole of a cobra, and isn't he cute, Mom, and nothing goes wrong. They get that. But they miss passages like Isaiah 49, where the Messiah is despised and abhorred by his own nation. They miss Isaiah 50, where the Messiah says, I gave my back to those who beat me, and my beard to those who pulled it out, and I didn't hide my face from spitting and from mocking. They didn't get the passage from Isaiah 53 that he was pierced for our transgressions. He was bruised for our iniquity. And by his wounds, we are healed. In fact, some of the leaders of Jesus' day took that famous passage, Isaiah 53, about the Messiah, and applied the passages of glory and light and life to the coming Messiah, and the passages of suffering, they applied it to the nation of Israel, not to the Messiah. They didn't put the two together. And these disciples who had loved Jesus did not get how in the Old Testament God so loved his people, and at the same time so hated sin, and at the same time offered sacrifices for their atonement, but these sacrifices had to keep on being offered, so something was wrong because nothing was actually sticking or clicking, and something more had to come in the way of sacrifices. They didn't get that. They didn't get the Old Testament picture of King David. The Messiah was, you may recall, to be the son of David. That is, King David, the best king Israel ever had, would have eventually a descendant who would be his son, who would be an even better king. And they didn't think about the fact that before David was crowned king, he had a miserable life running for his life from Saul and suffered terribly. And that was a picture of what the Messiah would do before he was crowned king as well. They didn't get the idea that the Passover lamb that had been slain to keep the death angel from killing all the firstborn of Israel in Egypt was an innocent lamb whose blood was spattered on a post, and that it was pictorial of something greater to come. They didn't get the idea that when Israel was in the wilderness dying of thirst, and Moses took a stick and hit the rock and water came out, symbolizing Christ the rock and the living water, that it was the staff that Moses had used to call judgments and plagues on Egypt that was the staff that hit the rock, which pictured Christ. That is, that Christ would need to go through suffering in order to give us redemption. They didn't get that. They just didn't. And so there's so many things like this that they did not get. And finally, they didn't get that in the Old Testament, when people had snake bites and were dying right and left, that the cure was that Moses set up a post. And as people looked at that post, they would be cured. But what made the post work is that on the post, he had to put a bronze snake. That is, a pole to which was attached in some way a symbol of sin was what would cure the people of the death disease they had from the poison. They did not think about any of these things. They only thought about Christ's glory. And that's why they missed it all. And he talked to them about that. Night is coming. It approaches. It's getting close now. They've seen the Bible in a different light. As he's talking to them, oh my goodness, familiar passages, one after another that they've read a gazillion times. They're looking and they say, oh my goodness, I never saw that. Oh yes, oh yes, oh my goodness. And now they're home. Their time with this guy is about done. They've had the greatest experience of their lives, probably, and it's about over, and he's about to go on. The sun is setting over the hills, and they say, don't go. Travel's dangerous, you know. You're liable to trip and fall over a rock and hurt yourself, break a bone. You're liable to get robbed at night. Maybe some wild animal is skulking about. And so they convince him by urging him to stay with them. They enter their home, and there's a simple meal. Now, in a home at that time, it was always the host who would reach for the bread, and as he gave the blessing and thanked God for the food, would break it. But here, the stranger reaches for the bread and breaks it as if he's the host, and apparently that's okay. What was it that at that moment made them realize who he was? The Bible doesn't say. Was it that as he bowed his head and gave thanks to God the Father, they heard the kind of familiarity with the Father and the kinds of words flow from him that they had heard dozens of times as they followed him, and they recognized the cadence of the words? Was it that he was so comfortable taking charge to break the bread, though it was not his home? Was it that as he reached for the bread, they saw something unusual in his hand and realized there were scars? We don't know. But something pulled the blinders off, and we read that they recognized who they were, who he was. Their eyes were opened, and immediately he disappeared from their sight. Why? Because what he had come to do with them was done. What was that? To show them that the Messiah had to suffer and then would rise, and that Jesus was that Messiah, was that one, and that they had not placed their money on the wrong horse. And so, the one who could, in his resurrection body, appear at will and go through closed doors at will, could certainly disappear at will. But his presence remained in the room and they felt it. Did not our hearts burn while he talked with us? And we read in verse 33 that they, not just that they got up, but that they got up at once and returned to Jerusalem after a 7-mile walk to do it again. And hadn't they just talked the stranger into not going because of all those wild animals out there and robbers and all the occasions for falling? Who cares? They could not stay where they were. It just burst inside them. How could they fail to go back and give joy to those 11 disciples whom they loved, locked in a room, who don't even know that the Son of God is indeed the Son of God and he's risen again? Back they go, 7 miles. They had traveled 7 miles through the Old Testament. And now they travel their first 7 miles in the light of the New Testament. But meanwhile, back in Jerusalem, things have been popping. One of the women goes back to the tomb. Mary of Magdalene sees the gardener. The gardener starts talking to her, and she suddenly realizes who she is, runs and tells the 11. And then Peter and John see, I'm sorry, Peter. Jesus appears to Simon Peter by himself, and Peter comes back and tells it. So when the Emmaus disciples get back, probably somewhere around midnight, and the door peeks open, and the Emmaus disciples want to burst in and tell their story, they don't get a chance because the guys inside want to tell their story. And so everybody's scrambling to tell their story. Jesus is alive. He's appeared to Mary. He's appeared to Peter. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. We know. Wait till you hear this one. And there it goes. That's what happens when Christians get together and speak about what Jesus has done in their lives. It's powerful and it's good. It's priceless. Well, that's what the story is. It's pretty simple. But you see why people love it. It's like a diner in some back road of Vermont nobody ever heard of. But by the time you've eaten the tomato pie there or whatever it is, you want to tell all your friends, or maybe not. 4 quick thoughts about this little passage. The first is that little word in verse 21 when the men said, we had hoped, or man and wife, said, we have hoped that he would be the one to redeem Israel. You know what that word redeem means? In the language in which it was written, in that culture, it meant to rescue someone at a cost. Maybe to buy a person back from slavery. Maybe to buy the farm back that a person was going to lose on auction because they couldn't afford the payments. That sort of thing. These people knew that the Messiah was going to come when he came and was going to rescue Israel, and they didn't realize the rest of us from all our misery and sadness. And they knew it would be at some cost. That is, it would probably take a lot of energy to do it. It would probably take some inconvenience, but he would get it done. Nobody, as one writer put it, had any idea of the cost of that redemption. None. Until they saw it on a hill outside the city walls. And it began to dawn on them what the cost of redeeming them meant. Secondly, a word about the scriptures. These two were certainly impressed that somebody who had been risen from the dead walked a number of miles with them. They were certainly impressed that he was full of wisdom and so forth. But what the text does not emphasize is that they continue to think just about, we saw him, he was with us. What the text emphasizes is this: did not our hearts burn as he opened the scriptures to us? Do you see that? Because as soon as they got home, broke the bread, he was gone, and they never, these two, probably saw him again visually on this life, on this planet. And yet their hearts kept burning because they had the book. Jesus once said, "Search the scriptures because they testify about me." And as you read the scriptures, if you read it primarily as a book of ethics or how to keep families together, or maybe Jesus as the perfect CEO to give you business tips, you'll learn some things that way, or comforting psalms for when you're going through a bad time, how the Lord is my shepherd, all that's great. But if you miss the point that from Genesis to Revelation, this book is about Jesus of Nazareth come to suffer so he could rise from the dead, so he could take you with him as he ascends up into heaven, you really miss the whole entire point. It's about Jesus of Nazareth, the Son of God, the Savior of the world. That's what it's about. And therefore, if you are a Christian and you don't spend much time in the Bible, if you say, I am a believer in Jesus Christ and I love him, but my Bible primarily collects dust on the shelf, your belief in him may be genuine, but it truly is thin. Because this is the book from which he shines. And when he goes away physically, this is where you find him every day. And he teaches you such that your heart can burn with joy. Thirdly, if you have a reasonably high view of who Jesus Christ is, Jesus gently but directly says to you, that's not going to cut it. If you tend to think of Jesus as one of the greatest men who ever lived, as a teacher whose words have a beauty that excel Aristotle or Plato, you really are missing it. Jesus said to people who thought he was a prophet and delighted in by God and people and did mighty miracles and works, you really don't have who I am yet, do you? You've really missed it. I do think all over the world today there are people in Christian churches at Easter Sunday services with an enormous respect for Jesus of Nazareth who have not come to grips with the fact he is God in the flesh. There is no other way to God. His bloody death on a cross is the thing you need to let get under your skin, because if you don't, you will have him not at all. He will keep going. Which is the last point. Jesus revealed himself to these people because they asked him to stay. Just because it is God who works salvation in someone does not take away the need for humans to make decisions and to act. And the decision that these two made was, he's going to go. And that's, we talk him into staying. And they did. I imagine that for some of you in a crowd this size, and many of you I know, and I know that this is true, have had a week or a month or a year or more where it feels like Jesus of Nazareth has just long gone and passed by, and where is he? Do what these two disciples did. You reach out for him and beg him to stay. He who comes to me, he says, I will in no circumstance cast away. Christian, in the deepest waters of trials, ask him to stay and to show himself to you in his word. Those of you who are not Christians, who wonder even if he's who he said he was, ask him to stay. I'm not talking about 3 weeks from now. I mean in your chair, this moment, where you are, shoot up a prayer and say, Jesus of Nazareth, I don't even know if you're alive, and if you are, I don't know if you can hear me, and if you can, I'm not sure I know who you are, but there's something impressive about you, and sometimes when I hear a sermon or read the Bible or talk to Christian friends, something in my heart burns. If you are real, stay. And because I can't seem to find you, you find me. And he has said that the one who breaks the bread and showed himself to these people, he will show himself to you, because whoever seeks, finds, and to him who knocks, the door will be open. Now, our Lord Jesus, do in this room what you did for those two. Do it quickly, if you would, and let a lot of people know about it. Amen.